Was it Black Lives Matter Plaza, with the big words Black Lives Matter outside the White House, outside Lafayette Park? You were youth leaders then. You were very active in Selma with John Lewis. What message do you and do you feel John Lewis had, especially for young people organizing today?
Well, that was one of the genius of John Lewis, is that he knew how to relate to people who were different from him and who had different orientations, different values, different philosophies. And that's why he was such a great leader, because he didn't put people down or ignore them or say a lot of negative things about them simply because they didn't agree with him. He found a way to make a way. And he was always looking at the synthesizing our approach,
Bernard,
rather than dividing.
We are going to have to leave it there. But before we go, I want to wish you a very happy 80th birthday.
Thank you.
Bernard Lafayette, civil rights leader, scholar, longtime friend of the late Congressmember John Lewis, his former roommate. We wish you a very happy birthday. And that does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
We're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Theater's virtual screening of The Last Tree. The Last Tree follows a British boy of Nigerian descent who becomes reunited with his biological mother. The film explores his struggle with the unfamiliar culture and values while learning what it means to be a young black man in London. Again, that's the Clinton Street Theater's virtual screening of The Last Tree. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Public Schools will be holding all classes online until at least November. Some federal law enforcement officers may begin leaving Portland as soon as tomorrow. And in international news, Israel's Supreme Court rules that Palestinian prisoners do not have the right to socially distance. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Portland Public School students will not be returning to the classroom this fall. The Portland Public School District announced yesterday that it will hold all classes online through at least November 5th. Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero wrote in an email to parents, quote, "It is possible that, unless COVID-19 conditions improve significantly, online learning will extend into the second quarter." Per state criteria announced yesterday, Multnomah County would need to reduce the number of new COVID cases by more than 40% to begin having in-person classes, at least for kindergarten through third grade students. Statewide, Oregon does not currently meet the criteria laid out by the governor to reopen either public or private schools to in-person classes. The criteria in that case requires a positivity rate below 5% on coronavirus tests for 3 consecutive weeks. Yesterday marked the 62nd night of Portlanders using their First Amendment rights to protest police brutality as over 1,000 people gathered downtown. Early in the night, black and indigenous speakers addressed the crowd in front of the Justice Center. Federal law enforcement emerged from the Mark O. Hatfield U.S. Courthouse on Southwest 3rd Avenue around 9 p.m. and sprayed down portions of the sidewalk with water, stirring up tear gas, pepper spray, and other irritants. The Oregonian reported that the overall mood remained low-key as groups danced and stood around the bonfire located at the remains of the Elk statue. Around 600 people remained after midnight when a person climbed over the fence and several fireworks exploded in front of the courthouse. Around 1:30 a.m., federal officers in unmarked uniforms again indiscriminately tear gassed the crowd of people and declared the gathering as an unlawful assembly. Portland City Council is meeting today to discuss adding a charter amendment to the November 3rd election. The amendment would authorize a new police oversight system in the Tri-County area. Text of the proposal states that the City Council will submit a measure for an act creating Article 10 that will authorize new police accountability systems in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties to be voted on in the November general election. The resolution states that, quote, communities most impacted by disproportionate policing and systemic racism have oftentimes been excluded from the systems designed to hold police accountable. It goes on to say that law enforcement is historically overrepresented in these oversight systems, and it may be difficult for law enforcement to objectively oversee their own departments. The text also states that the accountability system will seek to remedy past police oversight systems' inadequate ability to collect evidence or provide sufficient transparency. Governor Kate Brown announced today that, following a conversation with Vice President Mike Pence, some Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers will leave downtown Portland in a phased withdrawal beginning on Thursday. According to Brown's statement, Oregon State Police will fill in to help the usual Federal Protective Services officers protect the federal courthouse, the center of protest activity downtown. Brown said in her announcement today, quote, "A limited contingent of federal officers who act as building security year-round will remain and will stay focused on the interior of the U.S. courthouse." A statement from Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf made it clear he doesn't see the federal presence departing from Oregon completely. Wolf said officers from the Federal Protective Service will coordinate with Oregon State Police to protect federal property. Whether or not Portland Police Bureau will be involved remains to be seen. Wolf's statement went on to say, quote, "The department will maintain our current augmented federal law enforcement presence in Portland until we are assured the Hatfield Federal Courthouse will no longer be attacked." The dueling narratives are a persistent fixture of the Trump administration and have repeatedly led to confusion among those actually affected by the policies. Wolf said he was glad Brown had reached out and that, quote, "I am glad Portland has agreed to be a responsible city." President Trump later tweeted that if federal officials hadn't entered the city, quote, "there would be no Portland. It would be burned and beaten to the ground." This is in direct contradiction to numerous accounts that show the presence of federal officials in the city greatly increased nightly violence and did nothing to, quote, "quell it," as Trump had previously claimed. And yesterday, Portland Commissioner Chloe Udaly said the city is fining the federal government $500 every 15 minutes until it removes an unpermitted fence blocking a bike lane on Southwest 3rd Avenue. The bill is currently over $200,000, and Udaly has said that it, quote, "we will collect." The COVID-19 pandemic has led to an increase in house arrests and electronic monitoring. As Eric Tegedoff reports, that transition comes with its own downsides.
House arrest might seem like a good alternative to incarceration, especially during a pandemic, but it comes with its own costs. Ankle shackles are outfitted for electronic monitoring, which concerns advocates for people who are detained. Babatunde Azabuke, programs coordinator for the Portland-based organization Freedom to Thrive, says technology like this can be a Trojan horse.
It looks really nice on the outside and really great, but when you open it up and get inside, it's white supremacy, it's capitalism and patriarchy and state control.
Azabuke says some law enforcement agencies are using the pandemic as justification to expand this kind of incarceration. Freedom to Thrive, along with the Queer Detainee Empowerment Project, Media Justice, and the Yaya Network, are jointly hosting a webinar today at noon to educate people about the use of electronic monitoring. A Pew study found about 125,000 people were supervised with electronic devices in 2015, up 140% from a decade earlier. Azabuke points out there are penalties people might not think about when choosing house arrest over incarceration, such as paying for the monitor, which can cost up to $400 a month.
If you miss those payments, you're out of compliance, and then that can be costly to go right back into jail or prison. It puts you in this position where, again, people are being penalized for being poor.
Ozebuke says decisions on electronic monitoring and how it's implemented happen on the local level.
I think the best way to push back is to definitely get involved in a lot of these budget fights around how the police budgets are spent and where your local money is going for these technologies.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Numerous local accounts of irregular menstrual symptoms have been reported since protests began in Portland 62 days ago. OPB reports that at least 26 people ranging in age from 17 to 43 say their exposure to tear gas has caused a range of symptoms. Some report getting their period multiple times in a month. Others report debilitating cramps and fist-sized blood clots. One individual who has frequently live-tweeted the protests says she sees a correlation. If she inhales a significant amount of tear gas, she gets her period the next day, even though she's on a birth control medication that normally causes her to menstruate only 4 times a year. Trans protesters whose periods have stopped since taking testosterone report their cycles have restarted. Unfortunately, there is very little research on the effects of tear gas on the reproductive system. Dr. Sven Erik Jort, an associate professor at Duke University School of Medicine, has extensively studied the effects of tear gas. He says it's entirely possible tear gas affects hormones, pointing to a 2010 study that proved CS gas could generate chemicals toxic enough to affect hormone homeostasis. In Bahrain, Physicians for Human Rights documented pregnancy loss among those gassed during anti-government protests in 2010. And in Chile, researchers raised concerns that tear gas might cause miscarriages in 2011, causing the country to institute a temporary ban. Despite all the anecdotal evidence, experts refuse to say there's a direct correlation. Other factors for the irregularities could include intense stress and rising hormone levels due to that stress. We already know that tear gas affects the respiratory system. Comprehensive studies have proven that exposure to CS gas just once causes individuals to be at a higher risk for developing respiratory illnesses like influenza, bronchitis, and pneumonia. Israel's Supreme Court has rejected a petition calling on Israel to implement COVID-19 protective guidelines for Palestinian inmates at Gilboa Prison. The facility in northern Israel holds around 450 Palestinians, classified by Israel as, quote, security prisoners. Conditions in the prison make it impossible for inmates to social distance, with 6 prisoners in each cell. The Supreme Court upheld the argument by Israel state authorities that Palestinians held in prison are no different than family members or flatmates living in the same home. Israel has reportedly released hundreds of Israeli prisoners due to the pandemic, but has refused to release any of its Palestinian inmates. At Gilboa Prison, at least 30 prison guards and 7 inmates have contracted the virus, and at least one of those individuals is also battling cancer. United States Attorney General William Barr testified before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday, including talking about the president's false claims about vote by mail. With more on that story, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
When President Obama and I were in office, we protected federal property. We were able to do it without the Department of Homeland Security turning it into a private militia. And it could be done today, but that wouldn't help Trump's political interests.
Former Vice President Joe Biden criticized the Trump administration's deployment of federal agents to American cities yesterday and unveiled his own economic plan to help America address racial inequities. In Congress, U.S. Attorney General William Barr defended the approach.
We have the obligation to protect federal courts, and the U.S. Marshals specifically have been given that obligation. Federal courts are under attack. Since when is it okay to try to burn down a federal court?
Some protesters had started a fire, which Portland Fire and Rescue put out. But unmarked federal agents pulling peaceful protesters off the streets has escalated tensions, according to the city's mayor. It's the first time Barr's testified before the House Judiciary Committee since becoming the nation's top law enforcement official. Representatives questioned a long list of his controversial actions, repeatedly intervening into cases involving the president's allies, investigating Robert Mueller's Russian interference probe, and amplifying the president's false claims about fraud associated with mail-in ballots. Those claims are disputed even within the Republican Party. Ron Bishop is Waupun County GOP chair in Wisconsin, one of the 6 key states likely to sway this year's election.
I hope Republican voters take a second look at it and understand that the kind of fraud that they're worried about, there's not a lot of evidence of it. One of the things that people like to throw at me, social media and other places, is there are news stories of people trying to cheat with vote by mail. And I always point out, you're right, but those people were caught.
Bishop says older voters make up much of the Republican base in Wisconsin, and he doesn't want Republicans to lose elections because their voters were unnecessarily suspicious of absentee ballots.
I'm a Trump supporter. We're the Republican Party. My job as the county chairman is to support all the Republicans on the ballot. And I just think he's wrong on this. What aggravates me about it is the president is scaring people away from a legitimate way to vote.
Yesterday, Twitter penalized Donald Trump Jr. for tweeting misinformation, a viral video of doctors making unsubstantiated claims about hydroxychloroquine. He could only browse and direct message his followers for 12 hours. His father, President Donald Trump, without penalty, retweeted other accounts sharing the same video to his more than 80 million followers. Trump Jr. spokesperson Andy Subarian called Twitter's restriction, quote, another instance of them committing election interference to stifle Republican voices, unquote. But Vanderbilt sociology professor Lisa Fazio says the president's voice on Twitter is loud.
Twitter has really been extremely hands-off in allowing him to post things that probably other people would not be allowed to post on the platform.
And next week, Biden confirmed he'll announce his choice for a vice presidential nominee. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special interview on the connection between art and the fight for justice for Black lives. At 5:45, we'll hear News from the Boo. That's your weekly look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, we'll hear special public affairs programming. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 64 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, expect sunny skies and a high of 96. Today in history, in 1896, Maria Rebeca Latigo de Hernandez was born. She fought against and wrote about segregation, racial oppression, and the poor education that Mexican-American children were receiving as a result. Hernandez and her family helped create safe spaces and put much energy into protecting women's workers' rights. She was also the first Mexican woman to be a radio announcer in the United States. The quote of the day is from Jenny Holzer, a multimedia artist born today in 1950. The quote is a selection from her work entitled The Survival Series. Quote, in a dream, you saw a way to survive and you were full of joy. Court in Oklahoma has ruled in favor of Oklahoma tribes in a dispute with the governor over gaming compacts. This is the most recent example in a series of rulings around the country that uphold tribal sovereignty. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Oklahoma, a federal judge ruled against Governor Kevin Stitt in a dispute over tribal gaming compacts this week. The Tulsa World reports 9 tribal governments sought a ruling on whether the compacts had expired at the end of 2019, as Stitt claimed. The court ruled they did not. An attorney for the Chickasaw Nation said the decision was good for tribes and brings back stability and certainty. The judge gave both sides until August 7th to present any additional issues. It was unclear if the governor would appeal. The state of Oklahoma has spent more than $1.5 million in legal and other fees in the fight over the gaming compacts. Casino.org said Stitt, a member of the Cherokee Nation, has fought with the state's larger tribes to share more of their casino winnings with the state. This is the latest of several court decisions against Stitt. The Tulsa World reports the state Supreme Court ruled earlier this month the governor exceeded his authority when he signed new gaming compacts with the Comanche and Oto Missouri tribes. Also earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld tribal sovereignty in criminal matters in the McGirt versus Oklahoma case. The Atlantic called the ruling one of the most important Supreme Court cases of all time. It found that Congress never extinguished the lands set aside for the Muscogee Creek Nation, basically saying about 47% of Oklahoma was still Native land. Native leaders in Minnesota say the Trump administration is getting off to a bad start in its attempts to combat the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue. Federal officials announced they're opening 7 offices around the country dedicated to solving cold cases, but at an event to officially open the first office near Minneapolis this week, Native leaders say they were kept out of the loop. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
The president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, cut the ribbon Monday on Minnesota's Missing and Murdered Native Americans Cold Case Office. The event featured opening prayers from officials with the Little River Band of Ottawa Indians and the Lower Sioux Indian community. But outside, Minnesota State Representative Mary Kunesh Padin, who's of Lakota heritage, stood with protesters. The Democrat co-chairs the state's MMIW task force, but says she was never told about the event or what the federal office will do.
This visit from Ivanka Trump felt very disingenuous. It felt very scripted as a possible photo opportunity for campaign fodder for her father's re-election.
Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and the nation's highest-ranking Native elected official, was similarly kept in the dark. Next week, the Interior Department plans to open additional offices in Rapid City, South Dakota, and Billings, Montana. For National Native News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
Tucked inside a massive spending bill passed by the U.S. House of Representatives recently was an amendment designed to block a move by the Trump administration denying the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe their sovereign land. Casino.org reports Democratic Congressman Joe Kennedy III from Massachusetts introduced the amendment. He said the Trump administration, quote, used the COVID-19 pandemic to try to steal the tribe's land and define their people out of existence. The tribe wants to build a billion-dollar casino resort in Taunton, Massachusetts, and was working with a development group from Malaysia. In 2015, the U.S. Department of Interior placed more than 300 acres of land into federal trust for the tribe, including land in Taunton and Mashpee. But Interior rescinded that verdict in 2018. The tribe claims that nixed the casino deal, resulting in a $500 million loss. The Mashpee Wampanoags trace their ancestors back to the first Thanksgiving with the Pilgrims in 1621. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
In the last 24 hours, the U.S. recorded the deadliest day of the summer, with more than 1,200 confirmed coronavirus deaths, the highest daily count since May. With the death count rising by about 10,000 in just 11 days, 21 states have entered what the federal government considers the, quote, red zone of rising infection rates. The red zone designation in this case means that each state had more than 100 new cases per 100,000 people in the past week. Neither Oregon nor Washington are in the red zone, however, their neighboring states of California, Idaho, and Nevada are. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 14 new deaths in the state, bringing the total number of deaths to over 300. That announcement came just a day after the state had 0 recorded new deaths. On Tuesday, the number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state was 342, with most of the cases reported in Umatilla and Multnomah counties. Today, the health authority reported 304 new coronavirus cases and 8 new deaths. White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx said yesterday, quote, "We can see the virus moving north. What we're seeing across the South right now is both rural infections as well as small metros and major metros simultaneously." Yesterday, President Trump walked out of his White House coronavirus briefing while being challenged about his support of a doctor who claims face masks do not combat the spread of COVID-19 and that the anti-malaria drug hydroxychloroquine is a cure. Of the 20 countries with the largest outbreaks, the United States ranks 6th for deaths per capita, at 4.5 deaths per 10,000 people. The United States is exceeded only by the United Kingdom, Spain, Italy, Peru, and Chile. Nationally, the number of cases in the U.S. continues to rise quickly. As of Tuesday afternoon, more than 4.3 million people have tested positive for the virus. At least 150,000 people have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 16.7 million people in nearly every country. As of Tuesday afternoon, at least 662,000 people have died. Oysters have been dying by the millions on the Oregon coast because of dangerous ocean acidification, a phenomenon solely due to the actions of humans. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2007, baby oysters began dying by the millions at the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery on the Oregon coast. At first, the owner suspected bacterial contamination was to blame.
Once they partnered with academics and other regional managers, they found out it was actually ocean acidification.
Charlotte Regula Whitefield works with the Oregon Coordinating Council on ocean acidification and hypoxia.
When you burn fossil fuels, you release carbon dioxide, CO2, and that does get absorbed into our oceans, and it makes the water more acidic.
That more corrosive water can prevent marine species from properly forming shells, which can kill them. The Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery learned to adapt. It now monitors the acidity of the ocean water that flows into its tanks and has a system to adjust the pH when needed. Over the years, its harvest levels have returned to normal. But outside of those tanks, ocean acidification threatens entire ecosystems.
All the things that actually live in the ocean, from the kelp to the fish to the sea urchin, are all tied to ocean acidification. So when small changes occur, these organisms are at risk.
And protecting them requires reducing carbon pollution. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The 2020 census has been stalled by the COVID-19 pandemic. As Roz Brown reports, census workers seek out hard-to-reach individuals across the country.
Once every decade, the U.S. Constitution mandates that every person be counted as part of the census. But so far, nearly 40% of American households have not completed the 2020 form. The coronavirus pandemic delayed the start of this year's count, and many hard-to-reach populations haven't participated, including lower-income households, people of color, and young people. Kathy Lacey with the U.S. Census Bureau says expanded options allow people to go online, call the Bureau, or complete the paper questionnaire sent to their home.
This is an essential activity for the federal government and for the local communities, and we only do this once a decade. So once a decade, we ask people to invest 10 minutes into their future.
Last Friday, the Nevada Attorney General joined a coalition of states in a lawsuit against President Donald Trump's memorandum to exclude undocumented immigrants from being counted in this year's census. Nevada has the most undocumented immigrants of any state, accounting for 7% of the U.S. total in 2016. Lacey says census data is used to allocate more than $1.5 trillion in federal funds to programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Head Start, as well as schools, hospitals, and infrastructure projects.
If people drive on any highway or road, that's either funded through federal funds or they use the census data in order to plan for the building of that road or that highway.
In a surprise move last week, the Trump administration asked that $448 million be set aside in the next coronavirus relief package to speed up the census count. The move alarmed critics, who believe the administration wants the data to facilitate political reapportionment by year's end. They warn that rushing the process could result in an inaccurate population count. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
What does KBU News poet Dan Raphael have in common with President Trump? Let's listen.
Tension, fatigue, desperation. These may be the rare things Trump shares with most people. He's so worried about re-election, about future prosecution. We're worried about paying bills, staying healthy, safe, and sane, as well as that election less than 100 days away. Plus, most of us aren't millionaires and compulsive liars. He lied about being invited to throw out the first pitch at a Yankees game, then 3 days later said he was too busy with COVID. Another lie. Most of us laugh occasionally, Trump very rarely and never in public. Most of us feel kindly toward a wide range of people. The new normal, at its core, is a lot like the old one. The difference is more of us aren't getting what we need. Fewer of us are prospering with a growing certainty of worse things. We just don't know which. All these different time scales, daily meals, monthly rent, schools reopening, November elections, virus waiting patiently, planet slowly disassembling. In highly improbable times like this, our luck could change. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Charles Chambry, and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Roz Brown, Megan Kamrick, Anthony Lizowitz, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, a space dedicated to sharing, exploring, and reporting on the latest stories and situations happening nationally in African American and Black society. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative journalism with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring an interview with Lydia Yuknovich about her book Verge. The novel has been described as a fiercely empathetic group portrait of the marginalized and outcasted in a moment of crisis. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Coronavirus has constricted daily life, while difficult, has been an occasion to get connected with people we may have fallen out of contact with. And with the power of the current movement for racial justice, there's a lot to talk about. Tyrone Coleman is a veteran, musician, and songwriter. He has been active in the movement for racial justice. He's also the head of an organization called The Art of Giving Me. KBOO's Charles Chambry speaks with Coleman about their shared past, where they find themselves now, and the impacts of the deaths of George Floyd, Trayvon Martin, and Vanessa Guillen.
I'm excited to have my friend here, Tyrone Coleman, on the show to share his story, his life. Tyrone, how are you, my friend?
What's going on, brother?
I'm doing all right. Good to see you. Long time no see. It's been a long time coming. How long has it been, by the way?
Man, it's been a minute. I don't even count. It's probably been, what, 10, 12, 15 years?
Yeah, it's been a long time. Where did we meet at? We met in the military?
Yeah, man, you know, met in 2003 in Babenhausen, Germany, right before we were about to get deployed, man. Did you ever think we would get deployed?
That's a good question. I wasn't prepared for that. I when we got there though, they said we would be deployed. So because we're close to Germany, but if I knew that we're going to be deployed, I would have never joined at that time.
Listen, real quick.
This is not about me. This is about you.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I can interview you too. Listen, man, a real story. I swear to God, I thought this to myself. Probably like everybody else, man. They're like, yo, you're going to get deployed. You're going to deploy. I ain't getting no deployed. I don't know what y'all talking about. I'm just here for college. That's it. And 3 weeks later, where did we go? We had to go to, where's our first stop? I forgot.
I went the second time around. Right?
Yeah.
So later for the first time.
Got off the plane, it was 123 degrees. It was so hot that day. But yeah, I'm glad that part of our lives are over.
Very nice. Good. And the last time we spoke was on like a week ago, I think it was. Like a week ago, we kind of touched bases. We hadn't seen each other for a long time since then, since FaceTime.
Yes.
Yeah, I was teasing you about your family because you have six kids, and you got triplets.
Triplets.
How'd you do that, my friend?
Yeah, man, I wanted you to be the godfather. You said no. I don't know why, but anyway, man, yeah, six kids, man. The last three are triplets, so that's why the large amount. And it's quite amazing, man. We just weren't really still kind of shocked. But yeah, it's a blessing, man. It's a blessing.
That is a blessing. That is a blessing. So who is Tyrone Coleman? Tell me about your life, your background, all that good stuff. Tell us about you, because you are an artist, writer, and a musician. Please tell us about your life and story, just in a general way, and then we'll get down to the specifics of your music and your
yes.
systems and what your program is about, because it's the art of giving me, I think it's called.
I'm in clothing, too. I do fashion a little bit. You can't tell I'm a model, but I am a model. You know what I'm saying? Anybody want to hire me, hire me. But real quick, yes, I'm a father of six, a proud father of six, a married husband for over 12 years, originally from 914 Westchester, New York. Moved around a lot of, but mostly grew up in Greenberg and Peekskill, New York. So shout outs to Peekskill and Greenberg, of course, you know what I'm saying? Shout outs to White Plains, Yonkers, all them places. But yes, man, so in 2000, and, two, joined the military, 03, met you, right? We did a couple of deployments together, got out in 09, the Great Depression or Recession, and that was some tough times, right? Mm-hmm. So got out, and then that's how my journey actually started to begin. A couple of years in 2017, I started a thing called The Art of Giving Me. Mm-hmm. The Art of Giving Me is basically my self-reflection on a lot of topics, right? I try to use myself, my life, and as an example to inspire others, right? As inspire others. I call myself, my writing name and my musician's name is Canvas, right? I feel like I am just a tool to help other people grow. I don't take any credit for anything I do. I always feel like I point it up to the man upstairs, and he gives me ideas and he inspires me to inspire others.
I love that. You said Canvas, so your artist name is Canvas?
Canvas, man. You know what I'm saying? Like the thing they draw on, you know that.
Yeah, that's nice. I like that name, Canvas. Well, let's talk about it. Let's talk about your music, Canvas. So let's talk about, because I know you just produced a few singles, I guess. And so let's talk about your music and what is the reason behind it, or at least what was the message, and how is it different from other artists that are out there and their music?
Yes. So I always love music, right? Music has always been a passion of mine, and I wanted to always dive into it. But me, I always felt like I couldn't do it, right? Like, I felt like the way I talk, the way I was born dyslexic. So I had fears and doubts, and finally, I felt like, yo, if not now, then when? So I really broke out of that, and yes, I may be a little bit older, but like, my passion, my gift will not die, right? Or at least not die and not be shared with the world. So fast forward now. So talking about today's topic, one of the songs I just dropped a month ago is called Skittles and Iced Tea. It talks about Trayvon Martin's case. And in the chorus of the song, I say, when I look at my son, all I see is Trayvon. One second, he's here. Next second, he's gone. And in the beginning of the song, I said, this is the realest song I ever wrote. In reality, that was actually my first song. Like, I knew, like, my first song, like, if I don't say anything, this is gonna be the realest song I ever write. And I said, it's the realest song I ever wrote, and I pray to God I never quote. When I say things like that, I wanna put it into, I wanna give it a narrative that, hey, you know what? We have a lot of hip hop that talks about a lot of other topics, a lot of other messages, right? And a lot of the messages are really superficial, right? Mm-hmm. So as a black father, there's a million, billions of great, or millions of great black fathers, right? And to have that perspective, like, hey, you know what? When I send my son out, because of the stereotypes and fears that society has of him, that's a genuine fear that a black man may have when they send their son out. That, hey, you know what? I gotta teach my son how to interact with the police. Because if I don't, he could lose his life. So I just felt like that was one of the realest songs that I ever wrote. I had my boy on it, Eric Hurt, he's on there. I'm actually underneath his label. His label is called Jetpack Records. And we just been moving, man. We just dropped another song called Kobe. It's dedicated to Kobe Bryant, and it talks about, you know, keep on believing, like keep on dreaming, like no matter what the odds are against you, keep on going at it. Like I said, again, with myself, a part of me, regardless of music, like I had always limited myself due to things, my surroundings, my disabilities. But yes, you can always achieve if you really just believe.
Moving right along. So you cover some content that's not superficial, and it seems that it's relevant to, because you talked about Trayvon Martin.
Yes.
As you know, Black Lives Matter, and also George Floyd, and even Vanessa Guillen. Are you covering some of those concepts, or those let's say crises and issues that are going on in our world right now? Are you covering those?
Yes, I am.
In your music?
I'm heavily involved in the movement. So yes, I support not necessarily the organization. We could talk a little bit more about that, but going on and talking and protesting about George Floyd and fighting for equality and fighting for a system that has for years and years oppressed us. Yes, I am knee deep in it. I just don't do songs. I just don't do tweets. I just don't do, post stuff on social media. I'm, you know, at the rallies, you know what I'm saying? I do donate to organizations that I know that that will bring about change. I will stop spending my money at certain companies that I believe don't have our best interest in at hand. So yes, I do it all, man. It's not just a song. Yes, a song, a post is powerful, but we could do more if we are actively involved.
Any final words or thoughts?
I almost forgot about Vanessa.
Oh yeah, you want to talk about Vanessa? Go ahead.
Yeah, you're getting old, man. You're getting old, you know that, right? On a serious note with Vanessa, right? Me and you both, sir, and we've probably seen and heard some things about the allegations or the mistreatment of females, you know, mostly females, some males, and this has gone on way too long, and it's just a shame that this young lady went missing for about 3 months, and no one knew anything that happened to this young lady. It's sad that the Me Too movement, the social media movement, all these movements had to bring awareness of, you know, what happened to Vanessa. So going back, the Army is really outdated, I believe, with the sexual harassment, with their policies and with their information and teaching to young soldiers. I believe that there's too many good old boys clubs going on. And we need to do something about that. There needs to be change now. Things need to change now. There shouldn't be another Vanessa. And actually, there is a case, not with sexually relations or sexually abuse case, but another young soldier from Fort Bragg. They just found his body in the Outer Banks, and he had just died. So this just happened while we're talking. So I don't understand. We join this, most of us join this organization, the military, the Army, the Air Force, the Coast Guard, whatever, to protect our nations. Who in their wildest dreams thought they would have, or we would have to be protected from these vile creatures who prey on young soldiers? Because we don't lack the information, we lack the experience. We are afraid that if we're E1 or Lieutenant, that we can't voice what's going on, because we may it may cost us our career. So yes, it needs to be voiced. And I'm an advocate, man. I'm always for the people, man. I'm always willing to do a work. One quick fact about me, right? I was born on Martin Luther King's Day, right? January 15th. And I believe I'm here to change the world, man. I believe we're all here to change the world, but I take that so serious, man. I cannot live a day, or I can't live my life knowing that I didn't make an impact, not knowing that I didn't fight for somebody who maybe be voiceless or unable to fight for themselves. I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to die for that. Like, real talk, I'm just willing to do whatever I have to do to make the world a better place.
Very nice, very nice. The art of giving me. I like that. I like that a lot. All right, so Tyrone, Coleman, Canvas, how do we stay in contact with you?
Yeah, please follow me. Please follow me. I'm on Instagram at Canvas from 914. Also, there is a Facebook page, The Art of Giving Me.
Very nice. So you heard his story, his life, and how he's helping others in the community, and just his desire to help people overall, given himself and the ministry or the program, which is The Art of Giving Me. We want to thank him for coming to the show. We thank you for watching the show, Interviews with Charles Chambers. Chris Charles.
Thank you for having me.
That was KBOO's Charles Chambers speaking with Tyrone Coleman, also known as Canvas. We will go out on Canvas's song featuring Eric Hart, entitled Skittles and Iced Tea. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
It's a blessing. Yep. Things can change in a second. If you do not get what I'm talking about, here's a lesson. On systemic oppression, they teach the police that black people are less than. We're wild, we're crazy, we're violent, we're angry, and we just got too much aggression. That's why they feel threatened when we ain't got weapons. We're 13% of the population, but 40% of the prison. If we do the same crime, then we're more likely to be arrested than convicted. And that ain't nothing I'm making up. You can look it up, that's statistics. If you don't think this a reality, you need to be a little more realistic. Cause I got a son and I got three daughters, man. Man, I gotta teach them about Oscar Grant and Sandra Bland. Y'all just don't understand. It's crazy to live in a world full of hate, and this world full of hate. So stop talking about make America great again and really try to make it great. We gotta change the fate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening.